Equanimity is one of the concentration absorptions. It's one of the paramis, or the perfections. That equanimity doesn't leave metta or mudita or compassion behind. It is pervaded with them. In the quote that I used yesterday, equanimity gives selflessness to love. It gives patience, courage, and fearlessness to compassion. It guards joy from sentimentality. And it brings all of the noble qualities of the heart together in freedom. In Pali, the word is upekkha, and it is a word that the Buddha often uses interchangeably with nibbana. It is actually important to recognize that. It is often used instead of nibbana. It is, in a sense, what all insight is aimed towards, the blowing out of the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion, their uprooting, their cessation. Now, if metta teaches us to befriend all events and experiences, compassion teaches us the arts of empathy and responsiveness, with the commitment to alleviate suffering and to bring its causes to an end. Joy replenishes and restores the heart. And equanimity is understanding what it really means to stand in the midst of all of this, all experience, with unshakable balance. At times, upekkha is translated as to look over, or to be a guardian of, to stand in the middle of, as unshakable liberation. It is said to be the quality that protects the heart from the extremes of life that we find ourselves in. But it also protects the heart from the reactions to events that we cannot control, that so easily leave us feeling helpless or lost or confused. So I want to look at equanimity in three areas. I think they're universal areas. I think they're common to each of our lives. So the first of those areas is the domain of what does it mean to live with equanimity amidst the river of events and experiences that make up each of our lives, the 10,000 joys and sorrows. What does it mean to stand in the middle with equanimity of the experiences of change, of loss, of uncertainty, the unpredictable, so much that we can't control? Every day, each one of us, we see that our sense doors are flooded with thousands of sights, of sounds, of sensations, of thoughts, of feelings. We already stand in the middle of all of this. What equanimity teaches us is how to stand in the midst with a heart that can't be shattered, but instead to cultivate a mind and heart of boundless stability in the midst of the unstable. The second dimension of equanimity is the domain of human relationships, a place where it's often needed. Those we love, those we fear, those we dislike, those we cherish, and those we feel indifferent towards. And the third dimension of equanimity is what the Buddha called the signless deliverance of the mind. I will explain that later on, hopefully a little bit more. The cessation of all greed, hatred, and delusion, the awakened heart. Important to remember that equanimity is a practice. It's a path cultivated, most likely not in the calmest moments of our lives, But most likely in the moments when we find ourselves most shaken, most agitated, most lost in reactivity. It's not a state. I don't think of equanimity as a state. It's a way. It's a way of being present. It's a practice of insight. And I think in its deepest sense, it's a commitment of the heart to liberation. So let's spend some time with each of these domains. By the way, again, once more, if you lose your crystal quality of attention, stand up. Let's take this first domain of events and experiences. The winds of praise and blame, success, failure, pleasure and pain, gain and loss that blow through all of our lives, and none of us are exempt. Praise, success, pleasure, gain, we mostly embrace with delight. We're very happy about it. Often we embrace those events with some grasping and some clinging. Blame, failure, pain, loss, part of all of our lives. We very frequently, we fear them, we resist them, we become agitated. I do have a rather nice quote about this somewhere, if I can find it. But I can't. So we'll deal with that one. We see that in our mind we very often swing between highs and lows, elation and despair, excitement and boredom, fear and hope. And we become agitated. And we see how much energy and time and dedication we bring to rearranging the conditions of our lives so we have only pleasure, gain, success, and praise. And how much energy and dedication we bring to avoiding pain and blame and failure and loss. We all have our own pathways in this life. And often these endeavors that require so much energy actually leave us feeling rather exhausted. And we live, as I've mentioned several times over these days, with the ideology that the well-being of our hearts and our happiness depends upon the world of events and conditions. And indeed, we really should be exempt from the first noble truth. And the teaching does ask us to question this. We may or we may not have people who love us. We are very likely to have those who dislike us. We may receive praise. Most of us will surely receive some blame and criticism in this life. At times, life works out the way we want and expect, and we all have our own ration of disappointment. People are not always who we think they should be. We are not always the person we think we should be, kind, generous. We often think things shouldn't be happening. In fact, this word should articulates our sense of disappointment and at times failure. We live in the illusion that we should be able to control most things. We live in the illusion that we should be able to control the endlessly changing conditions of this life. And it's an illusion that is constantly being shattered. We will be deeply touched by events, and equanimity does not imply indifference. We will be deeply touched by events, sadness, joy. We are not invulnerable. And in fact, wisdom and compassion really relies upon us being touched. But we can learn to stand in the midst of all of this with balance and poise and equanimity. There's a lot of insight needed for equanimity to develop. And the very core insights within the Buddhist teaching But they're not strange or esoteric insights. They're things we all, intellectually at least, know and acknowledge in our own experience. Certainly the insight part of equanimity knows clearly and deeply about impermanence. Knows this. Not theoretically, not as a philosophical discussion, but somehow in our bones we actually know about impermanence, and we're not arguing with it anymore. We know that we do not hold in our hands the power to dictate the way that conditions and events unfold. Equanimity knows about dukkha, about unsatisfactoriness, rather than refusing it. Equanimity actually really knows about non-self, that it's not my fault. That it's not my fault that we couldn't control conditions. Equanimity also knows that we do hold in our hands the tools and the developed capacity to respond with balance and compassion. The insight part of equanimity discerns the difference between the events and conditions that we find ourselves in and our reactions to them. They are not the same. I had a very clear example of this a couple of years ago. I must say, I needed to have some eye surgery, and as any of you who've ever had eye surgery knows that, you know, you're awake, basically. This is the bottom line. You're awake. So this eye surgery didn't quite work out the way they thought they was supposed to. So instead of being a 15-minute eye surgery, this was an hour and a half eye surgery, you know, with two surgeons, and I'm awake and I'm listening to these guys, you know. No, you're about to nick the cornea, I'll take over here. No, you're too near the retina, I'm gonna move you over here. And I'm lying there and my first thought is, this really sucks. You know, actually, my thought was just like, this is really terrible. And then I realized, actually, it's not, you know. My eye is numb. I don't feel a single thing in that eye. There's this distinct difference between the event, which was actually neutral, and the emotional reaction to it. And it was so obvious to me. And I, you know, I found myself just lying there, giving a bit of advice now and again, you know. Like, the anesthesia is wearing off, I can feel what you're doing, you know. But I was starting to realize I was actually quite happy. And afterwards, these surgeons said to me, you know, you were really amazing, you laid there for so long. I thought, why not? I didn't feel anything. But this is so important, to know our reactions, the difference between events and our reactions to them. There's a wonderful poem that I know I do have, and some of you might be familiar with it. It's called Another Reason Why I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. You know this poem? The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He is barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on the way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony for a blast. But I still hear him muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently, as if Beethoven had included a part for barking dog. And when the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. Why we don't keep a gun in the house. what becomes very, very clear to us is that when there is a clinging to events, there is a shaping of a sense of self. Sadness clung to, I am sad. Disappointment clung to, I am disappointed. Events clung to, I am the I. This clinging is only a continuum of craving and aversion. They are the conditions of clinging. Craving and aversion are the conditions of clinging and grasping. Just as metta, compassion, and joy are the conditions of non-grasping. We can see so clearly that the development of equanimity really rests upon the understanding of non-self. That as long as I am at the center of experience, clinging and being knocked off balance will almost inevitably follow. What are the conditions that are being cultivated? Events touch us. Craving and aversion knocks us off balance. These are the reactions that endow events with the power to shatter our hearts. Craving and aversion endow events with the power to shatter our hearts. And we are never short of opportunities to meet craving and aversion with equanimity, learning to cool their fires. Now, the second domain of equanimity, which I think is probably quite very important to us, and also an area of great confusion, is a domain of human relationship. This domain of our lives where we feel most vulnerable. We long to be connected. Often we feel apart. And we don't always know how to be wise in the midst of both love and ill will. And both are equally calling for wisdom. We see that the anger and rage of others pierces us. We feel so easily slighted. The anger, the fear, and the resentment we feel towards others can leech joy from our lives and certainly creates cascades of thinking and obsession and narrative. To be able to love, to care, is the great art of a human being. Yet we can be as knocked off balance in our loving relationships as in our fearful ones. We can become infatuated with love, agitated, excited, protective. We can fear its loss and try to grasp it tightly. Then we experience the painfulness, not of love, but of unwise loving. It's so important for us to see that the mind that is lost either in hatred or in love shares some very common bonds. Both become very preoccupied, even obsessive about the object of their passions. Both in a very real way, the infatuation with love or the infatuation with hatred, seed inner sufficiency and autonomy to the object of their passions and actually become a prisoner of them. Equanimity is about balance, but it's also concerned with freedom, with the not ceding of inner autonomy and freedom. Every moment we face reactions of ill will or infatuation, I think we are indeed at a crossroads. We can either practice ill will and hatred or infatuation, and we do practice them by fueling them with thought, by dwelling upon them, and then we are actually practicing a kind of abandonment of another and of our own freedom. and the outcomes are pretty predictable. We can learn not to give so much credibility to our thoughts. We can cultivate metta and compassion instead of obsession. We can cultivate non-self. There's a piece by Camus. We all carry within us our places of exile, our crimes, our ravages. Our task is not to unleash them on the world, but to transform them in ourselves and others. What does equanimity mean in relationships of love, of tenderness, of affection? Certainly we don't want to pervade those relationships with coldness or harshness or not caring. But we do want to pervade them with understanding. I had a student who told me, he dearly loved his son, who he watched over a period of years degenerate into a spiral of drug addiction. And like every loving parent, he did everything that he could to stop that spiral, and nothing made any difference. His son continued to follow his own ways. And he said there came a moment when he was in an art gallery and he saw a painting on the wall of a woman standing on the banks of a river watching as her child was swept away in the current of the river, and the woman had no arms. So there was not... We see that dilemma in our lives of caring very much, but not being able to rescue another. We care for many in our lives, children, friends, parents. There is metta in those relationships at times of joy. There can be compassion in those relationships. But there's also such a need for equanimity. At times we see those that we care for making very painful and harmful choices, engaging in actions that can bring a waterfall of suffering upon themselves or others. We see people that we love become ill, age, frail, die. We can respond as wholeheartedly as we can. The heart can tremble with compassion. At times also we can feel overwhelmed with despair in knowing that we can't fix everything and that we can't always heal the pain of another or change the heart of another. This is the knowing, I think the bone-deep knowing, that is actually the heart of equanimity. Again, in a Sri Lankan text, I came across this translation of the equanimity phrases, saying, "This life is but a play of joy and sorrow. May we remain unshaken by life's rise and fall. I care deeply for you, but you are the parent of your actions and their consequences, and I sadly cannot protect you from distress." I think this really holds the essence of equanimity in human loving relationships. Embodying the understanding that, yes, life is a play of joy and sorrow. There is rise and fall, there is change, there is impermanence. And yet we know in our own hearts that we are the parent of our actions and we bear the consequences of those actions. And another person, no matter how deeply they care for us, they cannot always protect us from distress. And we know this is most deeply tried in loving relationships when we care for another. That yes, we may actually acknowledge change, the play of joy and sorrow, the impermanence. We know others are making choices, but we still want to be able to protect them from distress. And there's nothing wrong with that wanting and that wishing. That is the base of compassion, it's the base of metta, it's the base of wise action. But actually it needs to live interwoven with the understanding that we cannot always protect another from distress. This is a very hard thing to live. Sometimes even when we hear the words that you are the parent of your actions and their consequences, or that we are the parent of our actions and their consequences, even we can hear that as a sort of judgmental tone. But it's actually not meant to be a judgmental tone. It's actually just meant to be an acknowledgement of what is. We know it is so. We make choices. We engage in certain thought patterns. We make choices about what guides and informs our lives. Sometimes our choices are conscious, and sometimes they're not so conscious. But they all have consequences. Whatever choices we make in this life has outcomes, sometimes obvious, sometimes not so obvious. But there is fruition of all our actions. Our every thought, our every word, our every act sometimes splinters into thousands of splinters that we, and ripples that we cannot always see how, what effect they have. But we do know we leave a footprint in the world with every thought, with every word, with every act. The words you are a parent of your acts and their consequences. They're not words of dismissal or dismissiveness. They're not words of condemnation. But we know just that our acts and consequences are born of our understanding or confusion. That our thoughts and our acts are born of metta or ill will. So this is true of all beings. So this is true of all beings. Just as we know as much as others may care for us and love us, they don't hold the power to change the pathways of our own minds. Only we can do that. So too is this true of another. In the moments when we find ourselves facing sorrow and pain in those that we love, in all of the world, we are actually asked to make our home not only in compassion, but in the very deep understanding of the way things actually are. The first noble truth, none of us are exempt. Sorrow and at times suffering are part of a life in which there is constant change, insecurity, and uncertainty. And part of living in a mandala of conditions at times coming together in ways that we don't always welcome. It can be difficult and challenging. We come back to that phrase, it is as it is. It's not a statement of resignation. It's not a statement of despair. But knowing the way things actually are, in a sense, is the only true refuge we have in this life. And it is the home and the root of equanimity. It is the only refuge that allows us to find a small, still, inner space in which we can respond to the difficult with metta and with compassion. So the third dimension of equanimity is nibbana. And the way that equanimity is used to describe the fully awakened heart. And what I mentioned earlier, as the Buddha referred to it, the signless deliverance of the mind, the end of suffering. And some of you will be familiar with the Udana. I found the quote I lost earlier. Let me just backtrack briefly. The world of events. Praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, success and failure are the eight worldly winds. They ceaselessly change. As a mountain is unshaken by the wind, so the heart of a wise person is unmoved by all the changes on this earth. So, fast forwarding, okay? The way that equanimity is used as synonym for nibbana, and as I mentioned, some of you will be familiar with this quote from the Udana Sutta in praise of equanimity. For one who clings, motion exists. But for one who does not cling, there is no motion. Where no motion is, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming or going. Where no coming or going is, there is no arising nor passing away. There is neither this world nor a world beyond, nor a state between. This verily is the end of suffering. This is one of the most important verses in the Udanas. Do you hear, absorb that? I'm going to read it again. For one who clings, motion exists. We can translate that. For one who clings, there is always a state of becoming. Always a state of becoming. For one who does not cling, there is no motion. There is no becoming. Where no motion is, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming nor going. Not moving towards, not moving away from, not existing in a state of agitation. Where no coming or going is, there is no arising nor passing away of world states. When the Buddha described the world, he was always talking about the world of experience. There is neither this world nor another world nor a state between. So this verily is the end of suffering. So kind of in a nutshell here, what the Buddha is talking about is the end of the constructing process. The end of constructing an inner world moment to moment, which then becomes the blueprint for the wider world. It is speaking about an unshakable wisdom that manifests in unshakable metta and compassion and equanimity. Something from a German philosopher who puts this slightly differently. He says, I've come to the frightening conclusion that I am the decisive element. It is my personal approach and touch that creates the climate. It is my daily mood that makes the weather. I possess tremendous power to make life miserable or joyous. I can be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration. I can humiliate or humor, hurt or heal. In all situations, it is my response that decides whether a crisis is escalated or de-escalated, and a person humanized or dehumanized. We are the architects of our experience. We are the architects of our world. We are the architects of our own constructions. moment to moment. You may have seen this today. I'm happy, the world is delightful. I'm sad, the world is a depressed place. I'm fearful, this room is full of intruders. You know, I'm anxious, I can only foresee, you know, danger everywhere. We are the architects of our worlds, moment to moment. Sometimes so quickly, we move from one world to another world. And yet in all those moments, don't we believe that that is the real world? This is the way things are. My world is an accurate description of all things. My world is an accurate description of all people. There's a lot going on in that construction process. And in truth, it happens so quickly. And we see that part of the job of mindfulness is actually to slow down this construction process so that we can see the world that is being built. There may be choices. There may be the capacity to return to the way things actually are rather than the world of our minds have created. With perceptions and thought, we construct our world moment to moment, and we inhabit those constructions and react from their foundations. It's quite a personal world. In many ways, these constructions are quite lonely. We can't at times understand why everybody doesn't agree with us. But they are very, very personal constructions. I'm not going to go into this next piece before the break. So is there any questions about this so far? I mean, I really want you to be hopefully as clear as I can be on this. Yeah.
Exactly the opposite of everything.
Thank you for noticing that. Thank you for noticing that.
So how do you start?
You have started. I mean, the one thing we can be quite certain of is the Dharma is quite countercultural. It always has been countercultural. It always has been swimming against the tide. You can be sure of that. So in a way, it's a kind of revolution of values. It's a revolution of ways of seeing. I remember this so clearly from when I started. And I started in a group of a Tibetan refugee village with people who had lost everything, you know, who'd been tortured, who'd seen their families killed, who'd ended up as refugees. And they lived without a sense of any kind of vengeance or anger. I couldn't understand that. Because certainly in the value system if I had been raised in, that if somebody hurt you, you know, you did your best to get your own back. You didn't cultivate compassion and understand the emptiness of ill will, you know, and where it came from. It was like, what? It was like that. But at the same time, there was something, I don't know how it is for you, but for me, there was something so manifestly unarguable in that pathway that I had sort of this feeling of coming home, actually, as if I'd been living in a foreign country. And sometimes I was coming home and I thought, well, actually, yeah, this is a more noble way to live. But it does overturn assumptions. And actually, you know, I think we can be glad about that. But you are started. The Buddha said, always there are three steps to insight, you know, three steps to very radical inner change. And he said the first step is always to listen to the teaching. Then he said, you go from there and you listen to the teaching and you examine it in your own experience. And you look, is this true for me? You know, can it withstand that scrutiny? You know, can it withstand that unpacking? Then he said, you practice it. You know, then those are the steps. Those are the steps of insight. So you're well on your way. You're well on your way.